Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Welcome to Pollock and Thurston. It's John Pollock and Brandon Thurston here with a packed edition of the show over the next hour, where we are going to be talking about safe topics like Donald Trump,
yes.
Saudi Arabia, fighters receiving a nine-figure settlement after the early preliminary approval by one judge, Richard Boulware.
Judge Boulware is finally satisfied with this payout.
He finally said, you know what? You can have your $375 million. I'm done. I'm done with you MMA fans hounding me. So here it is. Here it is. Take your $375 million. But yes, returning to the show today will be Karim Zidane of Sports Politica. We're going to be talking with him about a new podcast series he has dropped where he is looking and exploring the history between the UFC and Donald Trump, which has been entwined over these last 8 years. Are you aware that in 13 days, your country will be holding an election, Brandon? Have you been following this?
I've heard that. I've seen that on social media. And have you heard that there's a lot of allusions that people can make and comparisons that people can make between Donald Trump and pro wrestling and apparently MMA as well?
That's true. That is what I understand. I also have learned that there is a certain segment of fans out there that the Powers That Be podcast was outlining when it comes to who Kamala Harris is going after and will some of our favorite online spectators be part of that
is
group.
Optimization of like the Jen O'Malley, Dylan and David Plouffe roles, you know, where they are able to persuade the that third category of people who do not vote, the couch sitters, if they can get them off the couch, and these are not like the secret MAGA people who are, you know, the 400 pound guy in the basement watching WWE. This is the person who just does not.
The 400 pound couch sitters, they're not worried about those.
This is a puck podcast. I've
yes.
learned. Okay.
That is the Powers That Be Daily podcast.
Yes. Are wrestling fans non-voters? They're hard to make turn out.
I don't know. There's certainly a lot of fans. Like they certainly have their tribal affiliations and are very, very headstrong when it comes to that. But we look forward to this this election dropping. And wouldn't you know it, that NXT will be running a swing state the day after the election. So that could be fun.
They are. That's true. Yes, because they're running. They're not running on Tuesday because I guess CW is going to cover the election. CW did not air the debates because, well, at least the vice presidential debate and NXT aired against the vice presidential debate, but they are apparently going to cover the election. So that means they're going to 2300 Arena, which I think is sold out. I was looking at the ticket website, but 2300 Arena's website itself in Philadelphia. And depending on whether I was on mobile or desktop, I was still able to see tickets, but it does look like they have sold that venue out. It's at least 650 tickets they have sold for that.
Yeah. I mean, I was checking in at one, like the pre-sale seemed like it was immediately sold out. And then the public on sale was at noon. And when I could get in there, like I was talking about like five single seats that you were looking at that were available, and it seems like, yeah, they just cleaned this one out. I think the tickets range from $75 to $250.
Yeah, it was a high price. Show. Yes.
Yeah.
Our listeners want us to know that they have all voted. All right. They've voted already.
Awesome. Well, we have, you know,
they're early voters.
Smart. That is our audience out there getting out the vote early. I'm sitting out this election myself. I'm not going
to
vote.
No, you're not allowed to vote.
No, I'm not.
We've got enough allegations of voter fraud. We do not need Canadians voting in this election. Okay.
Yeah. I don't want to feed that conspiracy at all. But on that note, we will get political enough on this show. Let's first start, and just kind of not exactly tying a bow on this whole UFC fighter or antitrust suit, but a major decision was made on Tuesday by Judge Richard Boulware. This comes after an initial settlement was agreed upon by the plaintiffs in both the Kung Lee and Cajun Johnson cases, covering all fighters for a $335 million settlement. When that one was presented to Judge Boulware, he rejected it, feeling it was too low. On top of the fact, the Cajun Johnson fighters, they would be receiving a much smaller percentage of that overall settlement figure rather than the Kung Lee side because of certain waivers that modern fighters have had to sign over. So they went back to the negotiating table, and a new figure of $375 million was presented, only covering the Kung Lee fighters between 2010 and the end of June 2017. And this was accompanied by over 150 fighters issuing statements about their health problems, their cognitive issues, and arguing that they need this money now. They cannot wait months, years for this to play out and potentially going through a trial and risking nothing being sent their way. So Boulware did state that that did play a factor in his decision, and on Tuesday issued a preliminary ruling. So this still has to meet final approval, but it would seem that this $375 million settlement, which roughly a third will go to legal fees to these lawyers that have been covering this and pushing this case forward over the last decade, will be entitled to. But that seems to be the end of the Kung Lee side, while the Cajun Johnson case is still at large.
So this is going to be, we don't know what the Johnson side is going to settle for, or if that part could still potentially go to trial. Mm-hmm. But assuming that they do settle for something, we're probably looking at a settlement that's total. This one's 375, maybe well over $400 million or something like that, based just to compare it to what their original settlement was that was rejected, which was 335. So just trying to get an idea of how much more, UFC/TKO is going to pay. And we don't know any of this through the docket. I've been looking at the docket, but we did have people who were there in person at the courtroom. So that's how we know that Judge Boulware did approve of this preliminary settlement.
Yes. Thankfully, we had journalists like Josh Gross and Filthy Tom Lawler there at the courthouse to convey Judge Boulware's rulings in Las Vegas on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So it seems, you know, a lot of these fighters, it is very interesting to see some of these fighters that, you know, most prominently, I would say Sam Alvey, who has responded that, I can't believe the fighters won this. I read every contract. The UFC did exactly what the contract was said. I signed my name to it. And ominously, to my knowledge, Sam Alvey has not opted out of it. So it looks like some of these fighters that were against these antitrust suits, now the rubber meets the road. You do have the ability. You could reject this money, but you have to opt out of this case yourself. And yes, thus far, no fighters have opted out of this.
Right. And Sam Alvey is going to get a payout of what, several $1,000, something like
minimum.
That?
Yeah. I mean, I would have to look back because he is one of many fighters that falls under both time periods. But I mean, this guy had a plethora of fights as well. You know,
and they don't deserve. He thinks that even he doesn't deserve it, apparently.
I've never understood the argument against don't give us money. That's not, you know, the UFC is the ones that are like, they are okay with this fee at the end of it, but their hope is that this all goes away. And next is the Cajun Johnson case that we will see if a settlement is reached and ultimately these antitrust cases go away, which if they do, I mean, it's going to, the way contracts are structured, it's going to be very, very difficult for your next generation of fighters to ever challenge this the way these fighters have been able to do. There's ways around it, but it is, the contracts are heavily restrictive towards this. And the Cajun Johnson case, they were arguing for injunctive relief, whereas the Kung Lee case, this was strictly about a settlement figure.
So were there not arbitration clauses in the UFC fighter contracts in this era then?
Yes, there are.
I mean, in the era of the fighters who are suing.
The arbitration clauses were only introduced over the last couple of years.
Okay.
And you have fighters that, even if they had signed contracts before, like if there was an extension, you're kind of acknowledging this new waiver clause. And yeah, it's all fighters now, they are signing off that any dispute would be done in arbitration and that they cannot participate in any class action lawsuits against the company.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm getting at is, they didn't have to overcome an arbitration clause to get this class action lawsuit to go forward, exactly. which is an issue that we're looking at in the AEW Kevin Kelly and Tate Twins lawsuit, where AEW, well, one of the things that they're moving for is a motion to compel arbitration because, hey, this is in your contract. You had an arbitration clause, which means this goes to a private resolution type thing where nobody in the public gets to know about it and sets no precedents.
Earlier this week, Rolling Stone did a feature on Rolling Stone really diving into the pro wrestling news of late.
Yes.
Big focus on Rolling Stone this week as they spoke with six ex-WWE writers, only one of whom went on the record. I thought that was interesting in and of itself, that you had five of these writers that sounded like they did not have a great time in this company, and still they wanted to protect their anonymity in all of this, which is their right. But I think that's telling in and of itself, stating that they asked to remain anonymous out of a fear of retribution from the WWE, their former colleagues, and rabid wrestling fans, those 400-pound couch sitters.
Yeah, well, I can understand the latter item in that series. I've definitely experienced rabid wrestling fans and the retribution that they can enact on your soul. I've suffered that many times.
Nothing tops the sign-off by Showbuzz Daily and making mention of their farewell address about the wrestling fans that will absolutely not be missed by the outgoing site.
I feel that. I have great sympathy for that statement.
So this was the one writer that was on the record was Michael Leonardi, who you might remember from earlier this year. He went on LinkedIn because people still do use LinkedIn in 2024. And he shared this story of an incident with Vince McMahon back in 2016.
And I said, hey, Vince, just want to give you a heads up. We shot this thing. The talent had a little bit of a issue with how this was written. And so we had R-Truth say the line as well. We think it felt good. We're happy with it. You know, I know it's my responsibility, but just wanted to let you know. And I remember, and I'll never forget this. He's staring at the screen. He takes off his headphones and he turns to me and he said, "So you didn't give me what I wanted." And my eyes got big and I'm like, and I said, "Yes, sir. I know. I understand." I explained to him again what we did, the circumstances around it, the limitations that we had. I took full responsibility for it. And then he just chewed me the fuck out. Pardon my French. Chewed me out.
That was Michael Leonardi. And if you are curious about what this segment was, it involved on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Neville walking up to Mark Henry, Titus O'Neil, and R-Truth, and he was scripted to say, "I have a dream too, and that is to win the Royal Rumble," which I'm sure had Martin Luther King Jr. Been giving the speech in modern times post 1988, I'm sure he would have had a sidebar note about the Royal Rumble as well. Neville, surprisingly, was not comfortable delivering this line to these individuals on this particular day as a white man. And thus this was changed to, I guess it was R-Truth that ended up
yes.
using the line instead. And this was the tweak in the script that did not provide Vince McMahon with what he wanted. Maybe Vince McMahon would have replied in modern times, "Did I speak Chinese to you when I gave you these instructions?" As a reference to this past Monday's controversy as a new era.
Which happened after this article came out. This article came out on either Saturday or Sunday night.
Yes.
And then on Raw, the controversy of the week is Carlito saying that comment towards Io Sky, correct?
Io Sky and Kairi saying that,
okay,
confusing them with being Chinese.
Right.
So yes, that was only one of the incidents outlined in this article by Rolling Stone. I mean, you had, essentially sexual harassment outlined here of one female writer being, held by the waist and pulled closer toward an individual and just painting an overall very toxic workplace. And later, a forum being done among, I guess it was the female writers, employees on a Zoom call and essentially being told, "You're acting like middle schoolers. Do not go to HR and we will police ourselves," was the message. And this led to kind of an all hands meeting that I was told by a writer at this time, like, that all hands meeting did go down to their recollection as well. So this checked out on my end.
And then there's mention in here too, I mean, there's really a pile of things here, right? The Brittany Abrahams lawsuit, which was settled in 2023. Brittany Abrahams was a writer for WWE, who is a black woman, and she alleges that she was fired because she pushed back against racist storylines and lines that were to be said on TV. And she believes that she was fired under the pretext of taking a WrestleMania chair. So that was a lawsuit that was out there for only several months last year before it was settled.
And, you know, at the end of this, you know, you certainly had Michael Leonardi that certainly felt somewhat conflicted by all of this and trying to also espouse like the positives of working for Vince McMahon and providing jobs for people. And that aspect of the article has been somewhat criticized. I think that you have someone in Michael Leonardi who is attaching his name to this that I don't think wants to paint himself as just, that this was all horrible, his time there. I'm sure many people that have worked for their company have had positives and negatives, but the fact is, I stated this on Monday, it's an expectation that you have a positive work environment that is not racist, that you are not subjecting yourself to sexual harassment.
It's not a luxury?
Well, apparently, you know, that they equal each other out to some. Like, you know, you got to talk about the good if you're going to talk about the bad as well. You know what I mean? It's like...
And yeah. I don't think he goes into it in this Rolling Stone article, but Michael Leonardi in his LinkedIn video where he describes his experience working as a writer for WWE, he had two stints as a writer. He had one stint around 2016 and he had another stint much earlier around 2005. And this was around the time that the Muhammad Hassan character was around and they had him doing sort of mock beheadings around the time of the July 7, 2005 London bombings. And he was assigned, part of his story is he was assigned to, you know, produce a video package promoting the Undertaker versus Muhammad Hassan match. And he sort of refused to do that and asked for a different match to produce a video package for instead. And he was essentially demoted because of that until UPN pushed back and said, get rid of this character. And then he was given his responsibility back and he quit shortly after that.
And I guess many people's response to this are just going to draw the conclusion, well, that was then, this is now, this is the new era, bad man gone. I think that we are left with questions that I think a lot of people have kind of done gymnastics, just jumping to the conclusion that everything has been cleaned up now when, like, the company, what level of account has it truly been held to that would emphasize any changes? Like none of these changes have been backed up with any evidence or substance. And that's not to contradict that there have been changes, but it does kind of leave us with it's leaving you as the consumer of this product with the assumption that everything is on the up and up now. Vince McMahon was a problem. It's gone. And now everything is cleaned up. And then when you see like a segment, as innocuous to some as it might have been on Monday, like this Carlito segment, it just mirrors what was outlined here in this Rolling Stone article, like how much has changed. And you don't know that. Like these policies are not transparent. They have said that, you know, what changes are being made? All of them. You don't know
everything. We're doing everything possible.
And that is kind of what you're left to. It's like, take our word for it and that's where things are left. Is this truly a new culture where you are encouraged if there is a problem to go to HR? Are you still in fear that if your superior is harassing you in this workplace, going to HR is not going to come back to haunt you politically within this company? You don't know. You would not have any of the protocols that are evidence of, listen, these are the problems of the past and these are how they have been remedied. And these are the steps we are taking and the people in place to handle these problems in a third party manner.
And I always want to point out, we did report on, there is a policy now, a policy that covers how relationships are supposed to be handled, which is not a policy that existed before the board's investigation into the allegations of sexual misconduct surrounding Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis in 2023, or in 2022. That policy was enacted a year later in response to that investigation. I guess what would be satisfying in this case? Like what answers or accountability are we looking for?
I think at the bare minimum, I think you would want to know of the presence of some third party that talents and employees have the ability to go to, whether anonymously or not, to share their concerns in the workplace, something that is known, that are answerable to the public, that there's some level of transparency of what protocols are. Like what are the difference in protocols today versus 3 years ago?
I want to say there is, I was shown that there is an AEW a way to submit an anonymous complaint. I don't know if WWE has the same thing, but I have to refresh my memory on that. But so you're looking for like some sort of an anonymous way or protected way with a third party rather than through WWE itself, rather than through HR itself, which, you know, reflected in this report, can't handle these types of situations and basically scolded people for going to HR with things that sound like real problems. I guess like when we ask Triple H questions, a lot of the negative feedback is, well, what do you want them to do? What do you want them to say? And I guess I'm looking for, some explanation about what's really happening. And in that case, in Royal Rumble of 2024, in January, just a few days after the General Grant lawsuit had been filed, he was not able to really articulate what the changes were. And there was at least that policy that was enacted sort of some 6 months prior to when he's being asked about it. And neither Levesque nor Shawn Michaels on a call shortly after that were able to really articulate what the differences were, at least concerning that policy. And there may be other changes as well, but it was not a very detailed response.
Yeah. And my last point on it would be turning the question around from what do we want from them? What do they want from us? If you are telling us this is a new era and we do not deserve the criticism that is being levied toward us, is what have they shown you as change that should not allow that should put a line in the sand between what was happening under the auspices of this company prior to the removal of Vince McMahon and what is happening now? Why should that benefit of the doubt be given? Because the public message has been, take our word for it, that this is a new company. This is a new era. So what do you want from us to have that belief that there has been a change?
And
I would be very open to hearing, like, I do not think that they are just scoffing at the notion of what has happened over these last number of years and what's become public. At the lowest benchmark being just for a PR exercise to clean up aspects of this and not wanting this negative attention on themselves to take those proactive measures. But I think if you're asking the public to essentially view this under a different lens, that this company has made these adjustments, there needs to be some kind of transparency to give us that reason to accept those changes have actually been enacted. And performers are given that level of confidence that if there is a problem with someone in a position of power, there's an outlet for those people to be addressed and not to be punished or dressed down like we're seeing in this article.
Yeah. And I think there are still questions about Paul Levesque and Nick Khan, who were members of the board of directors, around the time that these allegations came to light. And they were on the board of directors before Vince forced his way back in the company, or on the board of directors after he forced his way back in the company. So they were involved in approving his return. And I would like to know, what they knew about this and what they knew about the allegations of sexual misconduct against him, why they were willing to disapprove of his return in late 2022, but then were willing to approve of his return in early 2023, things like that. But on the other hand, I mean, that's from like a journalistic perspective, an accountability perspective. But on the other hand, I'm not sure I can make an argument based on the realities of the fan base and of the public that like is it a better idea for them to be as transparent and talk about this and openly say, you know, this was my experience with Vince and this is why I did this and that, and this is what I knew. I think that would bring more attention to it that I'm not sure would be a good thing versus just putting their heads down and trying to ignore it, which is what they've been doing for the last 2 years, because I don't think enough fans care, unfortunately. And the thing that really will matter or not is whether or not business partners care.
Yeah. And that to me is the underlying fact here is that if you were in WWE and you're being leaned on for advice, what cost is being paid for this lack of transparency? Like none. There is not any cost being paid by WWE to change any of this. Like there is not that demand for that either. And this kind of segues into a segment that was hosted by Piers Morgan. Piers Morgan Uncensored, featuring...
I would not have watched this except for to prepare for today's episode. So this is all John Pollock's fault that I have to watch this today.
Well, we did rock, paper, scissors, and Brandon won or lost. So he was the one that watches. I skimmed through this. It was it looked like an absolutely painful exercise. But the panel included Maven Huffman was he not? Now, this might have been Piers Morgan's accent, but in one clip I hear, he did refer to him what it sounded like, Marvin. And I'm going to go with the assumption that he thought his name was Marvin.
Yes.
Marvin from Tough Enough. Who else was on this? We had, of course, Vince Russo. Charlie Arnold, formerly Charlie Caruso in WWE, and Jonathan Coachman. But then we had a run-in.
Yes.
By Phil Mushnick, columnist that covered this extensively in the early 90s of Mr. McMahon fame. And he got to reconnect with Vince Russo.
Coach, he wanted proof. I just applied the proof.
How come?
I called you out. I called you out 30 years ago when you made it up. You made stuff up, Phil, 30 years ago,
keep
bro.
Shouting, because you're a fraud.
You're going to sit there and say
you're
we have a
guy.
Because maybe you're senile, bro.
Well, no,
maybe
we talked a lot.
Maybe you just got out of the chair, bro. You reported on stuff that was
don't
never
call me
said,
bro.
I'll call you whatever. I'll call you a liar then. How about that, bro? I'll call you a liar. You reported on
knock
stuff
yourself
that
out.
Was never said. I recorded
you have
the
no credibility.
What a goddamn mess. This was a total train wreck segment. And Brandon, your thoughts sitting through all 45 minutes of this?
It was not really helpful. I don't know. The early part of it was fine. It was interesting, you know, when they brought in Phil Mushnick. I don't know. I was watching Jerry Springer or what was I really watching here? Was this really something that was a productive conversation, or was this produced to make TV where people were in conflict with one another? I think the early part of this before they brought Phil Mushnick out was a more honest conversation and a more productive conversation about their particular experiences. And, you know, he had, you know, Vince Russo of all people even saying that he was not comfortable, that didn't sit right with him when he would see after he was gone from WF, you know, Vince being scripted with women kissing them or whatever he was scripted to do with them.
Which is a worthwhile distinction that when Vince Russo was there, Vince McMahon was not presented as this sexualized,
right. Because he's out of there by October 99 at the beginning of SmackDown, right?
Yeah, almost exactly 25 years since right. Russo's exit. And it's really that 2002 period onward that you see Vince McMahon.
It's really the Ruthless Aggression era. And where he becomes this, I don't know, he's not the foil as much anymore. He's this absurd character, Mr. McMahon. But this was a decent conversation. And then we got into Phil Mushnick, which was, I don't know, everybody hates Phil Mushnick on this panel, I guess. Or you know, I guess I didn't realize the extent to which everybody in WWE, at least of this period, was aware of who Phil Mushnick was and that he was somebody who was saying bad things and he was saying things, you know, unfairly about WWE. But I think there was a conversation about, you know, is about steroids for one thing, and there was not much depth gone into the notion about, you know, you had Coachman like saying, oh, it was a personal choice that they took steroids, which to an extent, sure it was, but Mushnick was trying to make the point that, look, Vince created this business and this industry where it was a great advantage to use steroids to improve your physique, because that made you a more marketable character or a more selection worthy character in Vince's world of subjective selection of who's going to get opportunities here in this creative process. And other things too about is Vince done? Is he gone? Which of course they did not get into the finer intricacies of preferred stock. Like I wish they had. But I would just add that the influence he had on the culture, whether we're talking about misconduct in the culture or whether we're just talking about his influence over WWE creative, I think he is really gone, but the influence and legacy that he leaves is harder to remove.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility, with digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Coming up this month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are bringing you three editions of Rewind Away, beginning with New Japan's Sakura Genesis from April of 2017 and the highly controversial match between Kazuchika Okada and Katsuyori Shibata. Later this month, we'll go back to October of 1987 with WWF's Saturday Night's main event on NBC, including title matches between Hulk Hogan and Sika, Honky Tonk Man against Randy Savage, and the Hart Foundation facing the Young Stallions. The month rounds out with WWE's Money in the Bank 2011. With CM Punk challenging John Cena for the WWE Championship in Chicago after the pipe bomb promo. Plus, Karen Peterson presents a special show focusing on the Queen of Villains on Netflix, weekly editions of Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course, ad-free shows, news and audio updates sent directly to your email, and so much more beginning at $6 per month, which provides instant 30-day access and extensive archives going back to 2017. PostWrestlingCafe.com.
All right, we are going to shift focus now and welcome in our next guest, who has just launched a new series detailing the history that goes back several decades involving the UFC and Donald Trump. It is Kareem Zidane, and his first episode is out now.
This is In the Red Corner, a three-part audio series about the UFC, Donald Trump, and the violent politics that unite them. I'm Kareem Zidane. I'm an investigative reporter, and I've spent the last decade covering the intersection of sports and politics. I've uncovered stories about corruption and authoritarianism, and how some of the world's most notorious dictators use sports as a means to gain power and control. And I'm here to tell you that the relationship between Trump and the UFC is a story I've seen before. One where strong men love buddying up to strong men. On In the Red Corner, we're going to unpack the relationship between Trump and the UFC. We'll go back to the league's inception and explain how Trump gave the UFC legitimacy as politicians tried to shut it down. We'll hear how the UFC helped Trump's presidential campaigns and tap championship fighters to help boost his allure.
So joining us now, Kareem Zidane of Sports Politica. The first episode, Do You Want to Be a Fucking Fighter? From the first season of The Ultimate Fighter, which is a speech that has been memorialized in so many different instances, comes from the fact that these fighters that were flown out to Las Vegas for this reality show were informed, you're not going to be paid for these fights. Are you crazy? And Dana White going off, how dare you? We've put so much money into this, and you have the gall to expect to be paid for your services on this show that we're going to create a franchise off of? How dare you? And how things have changed all these many decades later. Kareem, welcome back to the show. It's great to hear
from you. Hi, Kareem.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back, guys. It's always great to be on the show with you. Thank you so much for having me and for offering a little preview of my upcoming series, or series that just started, actually, In the Red Corner.
So you have covered this as extensively as anyone, but it's been so in focus in this entire election run for Donald Trump of not just like this sidebar issue of how the UFC has been ingrained in this effort by the Donald Trump campaign, but the fact that this has become a major area of persuasion and these glorified like propaganda events that have accompanied Donald Trump, complete with theme music and being adored by these sold out crowds. And it's become a staple now of a lot of these UFC pay-per-views. And here we are in 2024, and the person introducing Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention is not Melania. It's not one of his sons. It's Dana White.
It's fascinating, really, watching this history play out from the very beginning. Now, I really don't want to, I mean, I know your listeners in particular probably know the history of the UFC, etc. So I really don't want to bog them down with going that far back in time. But to really answer your question, I want to focus on just how we've seen this evolution take place just from 2016. So the time when Dana White actually stepped onto the national political stage at the RNC, the Republican National Convention in 2016. He stepped up on stage at the time, and this was the RNC that everybody thought was going to be a bit of a joke. I mean, we should have known better at the time, I think, or at least I will speak for myself and say I should have known better at the time. This was the RNC that Alex Jones was present at, where white nationalist Richard Spencer was there. But none of us took it seriously because the people speaking ahead of Trump were like the Duck Dynasty guy. You know, it was Melania Trump up there. It had the glitz and glamour, but it was hard to take seriously. It was as if you're entering this new absurd age of Republican politics. And that was really personified by Dana White, who comes up on stage and says, I'm sure you're all wondering why the hell this fight promoter is here. But he goes on this big speech explaining how Donald Trump was there for the UFC in its darkest days, helped them host events at his Trump Taj Mahal. And due to that, the UFC now stands loyal with Trump. And Dana White ends the speech with a quote that I think continues to stand the test of time, which is that Donald Trump is a fighter, and I know he's going to fight for this country. This symbolism has since continued to sort of propagate throughout Donald Trump's campaigns and his presidency as well. This idea that he is utilizing things like mixed martial arts, combat sports, and these powerful figures, fight promoters like Dana White and, you know, these other fighters as well, to present himself as a strong man. I mean, that's at the end of the day what this is all about. Envisioning republicanism and conservatism in this new hyper-masculine identity. And that's something that Trump really managed to embrace by using the UFC. And things only got more significant from there. If that RNC was anything, it sort of laid bare and foreshadowed what was going to happen moving forward. So almost immediately, Dana White starts promoting Donald Trump's policies. He was even defending things like Donald Trump wanting to build a wall, you know, at the border with Mexico. He went to tons of Trump rallies. He was with him on Air Force One multiple times. This is one of my favorite parts. The UFC even did a documentary promoting Donald Trump, calling it Combatant in Chief. I don't know if you guys ever got to see that documentary.
Oh, I saw it, yes.
Yeah, it's not even really available anymore to find, but it was a 14-minute case study in just how an organization like the UFC can sports wash Donald Trump's reputation. It's fascinating stuff, really. And it was this sort of approval from the executives and, you know, the higher ups of the UFC that sort of encouraged and emboldened UFC fighters to start taking a stand for Donald Trump as well. We started seeing things like, you know, Colby Covington, who became the personification of MAGA just in his presence, you know, with the MAGA hats and all the ridiculous quotes he had. You had people like Tito Ortiz, Henry Cejudo, all these, you know, former champions, all promoting Donald Trump. You just had Henry Cejudo just recently holding a rally in Michigan to try and get Arab American voters to come out in favor of Donald Trump. Like, we're still seeing this happen right now. But the difference is, and the reason why we came to do this this new series, this ongoing series that we have in the Red Corner, it's done by myself and Ellie Blyer, who's a good friend of mine. He's the podcast producer for this. He actually approached me with this, saying, hey, the stakes are actually quite significant here. What we're seeing now is not just this relationship, but we're seeing it evolve, and we're watching the UFC actually normalize Donald Trump at this very intense period. I mean, Donald Trump, when he's been appearing at the UFC now since he's had how many, I don't know how many, over 30 felony convictions, right? After, helping encourage the January 6th insurrection, all of these things have not in any way, his sexual misconduct, none of that has stopped the UFC from embracing him. As a matter of fact, every time he steps into a UFC arena, it continues to normalize Donald Trump.
Do you have thoughts, Kareem, about why UFC fans? Because he's received positively, right? He's cheered. I don't know if you brought out Donald Trump in other contexts in sports and entertainment, if he would be so roundly cheered. And like I'm somebody who's not watching UFC regularly. I used to watch it more so in the mid 2000s and times like that, where I don't remember it being so political or politicized. Like, why does Donald Trump and his politics, why does that gel so well with this audience?
We're in an interesting moment, I think. We have seen just in the past 10 years a significant cultural shift, at least happening in the United States. And honestly, I can speak internationally as well for the most part, because I've witnessed it even in my home country of Egypt. We're seeing, first of all, and this is like a highly discussed topic now, which is this gender divide in this upcoming election. The fact that apparently, according to polls, women, young women in particular, are leaning more progressive, while young men are leaning conservative. The truth is that it's becoming cool again to be conservative. The idea that young men are growing up to be progressive and to be feminist, etc., it's not as attractive as it once was. And the UFC seems to have notice this. And whether it be, during the time of Trump or right before it, they were aware that this cultural shift was about to take place, and they were happy to embrace it. And I think in terms of what the UFC did, it worked out in their favor. The UFC has always had a significant demographic of young men. Many of those men would be, say, we could call them apolitical. We'd say they're not even interested in politics, but a significant amount could be swayed towards conservatism or to the right wing. And that's what the UFC really took advantage of here. So given mixed martial arts' history, this history of the sport being a niche sport where it was an us versus them mentality from the very beginning, even the sport's foundation as an online space, as a space where, people get together in forums and have discussions. And unfortunately, these forums also happen to be the place where people started getting radicalized and being led down the path of, far right conspiracy theories. There is a significant correlation between how just the shift towards conservatism that we've seen and how young men have been a significant part of that. And they really present themselves outwardly in certain sports. And I don't think any of them have been more significant than the UFC.
Do you find, Kareem, following this as long as you have, that there's somewhat of a pattern where you can look at one of the key ways that Donald Trump has been able to communicate with these young male voters is presenting them as disenfranchised and being under attack, and I am the candidate standing for you? And it's not all that dissimilar to a generation ago when I think a lot of MMA fans felt the same way, like this sport could go away at the hands of politicians and was under attack. And now here is the person going for the highest office in the world, and he's one of our guys. And I think you have seen that bleed over to an effect that he is speaking to an audience that sort of in their DNA have felt like they've been on the outskirts of mainstream culture. And now they're being embraced by the person that is at the forefront of it.
That's an excellent point, John. And that's something I really saw very clearly last year when the UFC hosted Donald Trump for a UFC Unfiltered podcast, actually. So he appeared on this podcast with Matt Serra, and they spent the hour actually talking about boxing. It was apparently recorded right before his appearance at one of the UFC events. I can't remember specifically which one, but they spent most of the discussion just talking about, Donald Trump's history in the world of boxing, his love of Mike Tyson, his favorite fighters, his experiences as a promoter back in the day. You look at those YouTube comments. First of all, Matt Serra even in is like, I cannot believe I'm speaking to, a former president who's this knowledgeable about fighting. And that's exactly what the comment section said. It said, think what you want about Donald Trump. The fact that he can sit and have a conversation like this is something I can't imagine doing with any other politicians. It's a way for him to resonate with these audiences, make them feel like he's one of them. He's just like them. He can just sit down, have a drink, and shoot the shit. And that's what these people are looking for right now. So that's a small microcosm of this wider, wider concept that you're talking about right now, which is, yeah, Donald Trump's one of our guys. This sport that was once niche, that made us feel small, and that it was us against the mainstream culture. Well, now the guy who's supposed to be running the country is going to be potentially running the country again, is actually on our side. And this applies great for the UFC as well. You think of their history going from, you know, a sport labeled as human cockfighting by a politician, mind you, and a Republican politician on top of that in John McCain, to what, decades later, now being the sport that's so heavily promoted by, you know, the 45th president of the United States and potentially the 47th. It's such a significant transformation. And this has happened across all sections. You see the UFC running towards regulation, while in the meantime, this fan base has now embraced this idea that we are the sport that matters now. We stand here against not just mainstream culture, but even mainstream sports. The UFC has presented itself as an alternative to so-called woke sports like the NBA and the NFL. They literally oppose openly social justice changes or any sort of progressive values or identity. That's part of the UFC's brand now. And that's not a coincidence. That's not sudden. That's not a random change. That's a cause and effect.
And what's your thought of, like, we just looked this week at two prominent media appearances that Donald Trump has done with The Undertaker, mm-hmm. and is going to go on Joe Rogan this weekend. And, like, this strategy is a very, you know, finely tuned one, and you really can't dismiss the fact that, like, here is Donald Trump going directly to where he feels is going to move the needle in what's going to be an exceptionally close election, and is foregoing more mainstream outlets. I can't fault this strategy, but this is where we are, and here is your 2 weeks out from an election, and he's speaking to a WWE wrestler and Joe Rogan, and this is completely normal.
It's not just normal. I actually wrote an article about this yesterday for Sports Politica, which is my independent platform, and I titled it "Trump Chose a Wrestling Podcast Over 60 Minutes," and it paid off. Because I really believe that that's what happened. First of all, he tells The Undertaker in this podcast, I actually sat down and listened and watched this thing. So, you know, that's what I chose to do with my day. But he at one point turns to The Undertaker and jokingly says something like, you know, I turned down 60 minutes to do your stupid show. And there's such a, and sure, he sounded like he was joking, but there's a heavier reality to this, which is that, yes, Donald Trump not only rejected 60 Minutes, but accused them of, you know, bias and fact-checking issues, and basically, you know, claimed that, you know, this is not a real media outlet and I have no intention of appearing there. And instead goes on a wrestling podcast where he's showered by adoration by a person who's clearly a very big fan of his and had no intention of, you know, challenging him, questioning any of his statements, anything of the sort. At one point in this conversation, near the end, of course, The Undertaker chooses to bring up Title IX and this discussion about protecting women's integrity in sports. Of course, this is, you know, a conservative dog whistle for saying, you know, we don't want trans people in sports. But Donald Trump goes on this rant claiming that, you know, Iman Khalif from the Olympic Games was actually a man competing as a woman, which is complete utter nonsense. This is a person who was born as a woman. This isn't even a situation up for debate. It's complete utter disinformation that they both happily just, you know, built off each other. So this is the kind of podcast you're witnessing. A lot of people are going to listen to that. A lot of impressionable young men are just going to believe what both of them said there. Right? This is exactly what Trump wants right now. He doesn't want to face any resistance. He doesn't want to be scrutinized in an interview. He doesn't want people discussing his, you know, creeping authoritarianism. He wants to appear with famous people who are beloved, you know, by millions of young men. And that's the thing you'll always hear about The Undertaker, isn't it? Oh, he's one of the most respected people in the WWE. Who doesn't love The Undertaker? Everybody loves The Undertaker. He's so respected. Well, that's reputation plays a factor here as well. And beyond just the fact that Donald Trump is looking for these platforms that aren't going to challenge him, it's really a testament to what's changing right now, which is traditional media and their role in things like presidential elections. It would have been unheard of back in the day for a Republican nominee to miss that 60 Minutes appearance. It's a, you know, special primetime election special that they've always done historically. It's beyond, you know, unprecedented that Trump chooses to skip this. Yet that's where we've arrived in this media landscape, where Donald Trump can think of this scenario and think, why would I go on 60 Minutes when I can go on Joe Rogan, Theo Vaughn, the Nelk Boys, The Undertaker's podcast, and a bunch of UFC events. And that will work better for his base. Listen, I want to make one thing clear, which is we have no idea at the end of the day whether he's really truly going to be able to activate a base of young men that's going to just come out and vote and make the difference in the election. That's what they're gambling on. We do not know if these people will actually come out and vote in the end, or if they will actually make the difference. It's a risk, but it seems to be a smart one for Donald Trump. It's an interesting strategy. And it's funny that one of his campaign strategists was actually a former UFC communications director as well, or somebody who worked in UFC PR departments. So the connections between the UFC and Trump are seemingly never ending.
Yeah, it's a great point. And it's something that I think about a lot just in doing what we do, is like everyone has a platform now. Everyone is sort of a journalist, I think, has become one. If you've got like a public Twitter account, or if you've got a podcast, in essence, like Pat McAfee has become a journalist and The Undertaker has become a journalist, so that you don't have to face an interview where somebody's going to ask you challenging questions. You go to the and look, these people are TV stars and they've got a huge audience, and they're capable of gathering millions of people. And I think this is sort of true of social media as well, in that like sources don't need to talk to us, to reporters, when they can just tweet it out themselves to their millions of followers. We no longer have this platform that is differentiated. We no longer have like this big platform. They have anything, have bigger platforms.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to mention one thing here, which I agree with you, Brendan, but I would distinguish it and say these people aren't necessarily journalists. They are media personalities. And the reason I say that is because journalists are still held to, you know, ethical standards, you know, rigorous standards, or at least you would assume so. Theoretically, we're supposed to be.
I'm not saying they're good journalists.
Fair enough. But I think they happily want to play the role of a media personality without ever having to face any of the ethical concerns of a journalist. They would never want to label themselves as journalists, right? Because they would never want to have to face those ethical issues, right? They don't.
It's actually a badge of honor for, like, The Undertaker even proclaiming, we're not journalists. And that's viewed as a positive, where you mm-hmm. turn that title into just rife for attack if you want to label yourself as such. We also want to have you on because, you know, we're coming off of both the recent Beterbiev fight that took place in Saudi Arabia this past weekend. PFL was just there for their Battle of the Giants pay-per-view. And WWE is going to make their biannual stop a week from Saturday for Crown Jewel. And this is always a topic that comes up, but it's just becoming more and more prevalent with the rise of Turki Alalshikh, who, it's funny, in just searching for him now on Google, everything is attached to just boxing now. Like, that is his core identity, is this guy that is bringing these fights to people. And it's interesting to see the response of various fan bases, where, not to paintbrush everyone, but in boxing, it's like this guy is viewed as someone that he's putting the fights together that we would not get otherwise. In MMA, it feels as though it's just accepted. Like, this is another form of income and they're going to be deeply involved. And in WWE, while I think a large portion of the fan base kind of just accepts these shows for what they are, it is very notable when you have a Paul Levesque on TV as recently as last week, and he brings up Saudi Arabia, and there's audible boos from the crowd, and you do still get a level of resistance. Brandon and I were at WrestleMania this year, and again, when a commercial aired for the next Saudi Arabia pay-per-view, you could hear those boos in the audience, and it seems that, like, this is not an audience that has completely just divorced themselves from the ethical concerns at a time when I think many have just accepted, like, this is where combat sports is headed, and TKO is at the forefront of it.
You make a really interesting point, and I'd like to sort of follow up on that here, which is this discussion about, you know, people still being able to criticize Saudi Arabia, that hasn't been normalized to that extent. And that's interesting, because just a few days ago, actually on Monday, an open letter was published with more than 100 women's athletes, women football players, soccer players, some of the most popular soccer players in the world, signed an open letter condemning Saudi Arabia and its relationship with FIFA. So the primary governing body in the world of soccer. FIFA actually has this partnership with Saudi Arabia where Saudi's Aramco, which is its oil giant, is going to sponsor the upcoming World Cups, including the Women's World Cup. So all these women basically condemned this relationship and criticized it, primarily focusing on issues of women's rights and LGBTQ plus rights. Now, what I noticed was there was one statement that was later released by a Saudi women's rights activist. Her name is Lina Al-Hatloul. Something that really stuck with me. I'm going to paraphrase it here and say, you know, as long as Saudi Arabia refuses to address its underlying issues of, you know, its treatment of women, its treatment of migrant workers, just generally its wide range of human rights abuses, this will always mar its continuous development and its ambitions, no matter how much money they throw at things. And there would have been a time where I wouldn't have necessarily believed that, because I'm a cynic in many cases by nature, and just watching this overwhelming, you know, tidal wave of Saudi investment, just it makes you feel hopeless sometimes and helpless as well. So it's interesting now that we're seeing this level of pushback, and what you're talking about with these boos, that's actually so significant. And it gives me hope that this is not something that's just going to go away, that the idea that Saudi can't simply just buy its way to being normalized and to sort of buy its way into brainwashing everybody. Okay, we are no longer as repressive as we said so because we've paid this much for a boxing event. The truth is that they've made absolutely no attempts to really change the dynamics of how they operate as a government in Saudi Arabia. They've made no attempts to actually minimize human rights abuses. Their executions are on the rise, not decreasing. They're jailing more people than before. This is all still happening in Saudi Arabia. So why should we be under the impression that this country is getting better, that it's a reformed nation? What, because the WWE says so? Since when would I believe them, right? The WWE has gone a long way in normalizing Saudi Arabia to an extent. There was once upon a time where we would never have expected Saudi to have this level of investment. You look back on its early years, 2015, 2016, when they first started this Vision 2030 investment in sports thing, it was minimal. It was where they could fit in and where they were allowed to jump in. Now you've got them about to host, as in December, we're going to find out if they're going to host the 2034 World Cup. That is a huge deal and something we could not have seen coming, say, 10 years ago. A WrestleMania in Saudi Arabia, something I've said here before, is almost inevitable at this point. But the fact that fans are still vocal in their opposition to Saudi Arabia, the fact that you still have athletes willing to, you know, sign letters condemning Saudi Arabia and demanding that FIFA, you know, end its partnership. This is essential, and this gives me hope for us moving forward.
Do you, as we're this many years into the Vision 2030 plan, and for Saudi Arabia's side, do you feel that they have put extraordinary resources into rehabilitating its image and, you know, presenting itself on a worldwide platform, combat sports being a key vessel for that message? Has this been effective in changing that perception? And I guess what I'm getting at is there a point where they assess, like, is this the avenue we want to continue to explore, and that it's proving the dividends that we are seeking out? Like, this is not about putting on a pay-per-view that's going to do X amount of buys. Like, there is a larger goal at what is at the end of the road here for them.
And this is a 10-year deal that expires 2027 or 2028.
Mm-hmm. Listen, in terms of individual deals, like whether they reassess their deal with the WWE or reassess very specific deals, that will depend on, I mean, the WWE used to be Saudi Arabia's biggest boon at the time, right? It was the biggest thing they were able to sign early on. But now, with it about to host, you know, the World Cup moving forward, WWE has sort of fallen to the wayside at this point. Even comparison to boxing, it's not their big showcase anymore, right? It's not even the feature attraction of like a Riyadh season anymore or anything like that, right? So in terms of reassessing individual deals, that's very possible. But in terms of reassessing their commitment to sports, no. I absolutely think this is something that Saudi Arabia has already seen and has reaped benefits from. Listen, if you look at something like, you know, the public investment fund, Saudi's, you know, sovereign wealth fund, you look at the documents that they release showing how much they've invested in different sectors, right, around the world, whether it be health, agriculture, etc., private equity, they've invested far more money into all those different sectors than they have in sports. Yet that gets them almost no attention in comparison to just any investment they have in sports. Think of just the giga projects that they're trying to build, you know, throughout Saudi Arabia, et cetera, all these investments around the world. Hell, the equity they're picking up in things like Uber and other organizations, it's not getting the attention that, you know, a few million dollars thrown here and there at sports events actually does. So to them, they're spending less on sports than they do on everything else, basically. Truly, I'm not exaggerating here. Everything else they actually spend far more on than they do on sports. And the sum that they spend on sports is already incredible. So to them, it's like, why would we stop this? We're spending pennies, relatively speaking, and gaining so much attention for it. And even the negative consequences do not in terms of, you know, criticism or occasional pushback from players and athletes, etc., is not enough to stop that.
About 6 months ago, we talked to Bradley Hope, who's the author of Blood and Oil, which is a book about the Saudi government. And he had a different view. I think we brought up in the context of sports washing, and I think paraphrasing him, he said it's a little bit unfair that when people say sports washing, it's hurtful. It's not really what the Saudi government is doing. He said it's kind of a critical view from a Western audience to think that that's the reason that they're doing things like these sports events. So, I mean, like, what do you think of that view? And is that right? Is there some way that that's right?
I think I'd need to see the whole quote to understand. Based on just what you've given me here, I would say it's entirely incorrect. And if anything, it's a bit willfully ignorant. But again, I don't know the whole context of what he said, but I'll explain what I mean by that. Listen, of course, I personally don't use the term sports washing much anymore because mm-hmm. I think it's a very limited term. I don't think sports washing refers to reputation laundering. And that may be one element of what Saudi Arabia is doing, but it expands far beyond that now. But to suggest that sports in Saudi Arabia is something that's just about, you know, improving the economy or improving the health of the people participating in sports in Saudi Arabia, I'll say that, sure, that might be a component, but that's not it either. It's soft power projection at the end of the day. It's an increase in influence, global narrative control, and soft power. It's always been about that. Everything, and this is not limited to Saudi Arabia. We can say this, that we're viewing this from Western criticism, etc. Well, first of all, I'm not Western. I'm Egyptian. I've lived in Saudi Arabia. I understand how these countries operate. And to me, you cannot ignore soft power in any country, in any context, when we're talking about foreign policy and we're talking about diplomacy in general. And this is what Saudi Arabia is doing when it utilizes sports, right? When you're hosting major events, how is that major event? How is hosting a WWE event improving the health of your population? How does it promote, you know, going to the gym? Wouldn't improving that be building more gyms and more facilities and bringing in trainers and all that stuff? That's not what Saudi's investing in. They're investing in the
sporting and
the actual sport. You know what I mean? So it's about the spectacle for them. And if it's about the spectacle, if it's about these major attractions and attention, if it's about sponsorships, because they're spending far more on sponsorship than, say, developing, you know, infrastructure domestically. And even the infrastructure they are developing domestically is in the lead up to massive events like the upcoming World Cup in 2034, right? They're going to build massive new stadiums for that. That doesn't seem to me like actions taken solely for the benefit of a population. If anything, I would say that if the government is thinking about the population, it's thinking about bread and circuses. It's thinking about ways to tame and distract the population rather than actually thinking for their, you know, the greater good here. How can we make them healthier people long term, a society that's going to live longer and happier? Don't think that's in Saudi's major interests.
I'll try to play the quote that I'm referring to here, if you can hear this.
Term in Saudi Arabia here, because it has nothing to do with the way that they think about it. What they're thinking about is a few different things, right? They're trying to make their own population happy, make Saudi Arabia a place to stay, not to leave all the time. Every time you want to enjoy something, you don't want your population leaving the country to go next door to Dubai or somewhere else,
right?
Or to Europe or to America. So that's an element of it. The other element is that part of this economic transformation of Saudi Arabia, tourism actually plays an important role. So MBS genuinely wants Saudi Arabia to be a tourist destination, and that means making it entertaining. So they're building hotels, they're building event spaces. Of course, you want to have reasons to attend, you know, Formula One races and boxing matches and things like that. You know, so the country is transforming rapidly. It's so rapid that if you go visit Saudi Arabia 1 month and you come back again 6 months later, it feels different already, you know? So it's undergoing a huge transformation. Now, of course, MBS has always been very concerned with the image of Saudi Arabia as a conservative, repressive, negative place, and has been working very hard to change that. And so part of changing that is to prove it's not like what it used to be. So, yeah, you can call that like a sort of a PR event to prove that Saudi Arabia is different. But in Saudi Arabia, there's nobody there being like, let's open up the cash reserves for sports washing. You know, they're thinking we love sports. Our population loves sports. Tourists love sports, you know. So I think there's a, it's a little bit unfair to say that it's really just for this purpose. And it really comes from the point of view of a kind of critical Western audience to think that that's the reason they're doing this kind of stuff. And that's just not how it works over there or anywhere, to be honest.
Oh, I absolutely get the idea. And then parts of what he's saying, I agree with, especially the tourism, for instance. Tourism plays a big part in this, same as it does for the United Arab Emirates, where now they've just built the biggest, you know, artificial surf wave and are now going to be hosting major surf events in Abu Dhabi. This is a big thing for them now. So,
and would be the goal of a WrestleMania, would be an audience internationally coming to Saudi Arabia, experiencing Saudi Arabia, and going back and telling everyone about what a... what an incredible trip this was.
But,
like that.
But how can that not be considered part of soft power projection? How can that not be considered this idea that you're trying to use Saudi as a tourist destination? It's not like Egypt, which actually depends on tourism, mind you. My country depends on tourism, right? That's different. You need that tourism. Saudi doesn't need that tourism. Sure, it wants the tourism and it wants to distance itself and its dependency on oil. But this is also about changing Saudi's image, rebranding it and presenting it as a reformed nation without having to do any of the heavy lifting of actually reforming the nation. This is the key element here. Sports allows you to circumvent any of the actual hard work that has to be done. And I understand that, you know, that there's, there can be some sympathy towards Saudi's objectives. And we can say, oh, you know, the West is always too harsh on this. Sure, sure. But let's also not play under the assumption that everyone said that this was just about reputation laundering, or that the this is why I really dislike the term sports washing. I really, really do, because it's such a limited term that's almost working against us now. So I don't use it. But I do, when I speak about Saudi Arabia, I speak about a multi-pronged strategy that includes tourism, soft power projection, reputation laundering, right? All of these are factors for Saudi Arabia. And by the way, yes, sports washing is mentioned. Mohammed bin Salman himself said, if sports washing raises my GDP by 1%, I will continue to use sports washing. It does not get clearer than that. So I don't think this needs, you know, this, like, I think his argument comes from a, from an interesting place, but I think it's misguided.
And we also had, you know, a recent incident that got a bit of coverage, but I would imagine some people didn't even hear about this, was that before the Anthony Joshua, Daniel Dubois fight at Wembley Stadium in London, there was a journalist with The Telegraph, Oliver Brown, who showed up and had written a critical piece in the lead up to that fight and was turned away. He wrote, in 20 years as a journalist, I've never been barred from any sporting event for any reason, let alone for simply expressing an opinion that the host did not like. But on Saturday night at Wembley, with the stadium bathed in a garish green light to reflect the Saudi flag and the Saudi national anthem given precedence over God Save the Queen in genuflection to the money men, I found myself marooned at the entrance, told my credential for Anthony Joshua's world title fight against Daniel Dubois had been revoked. The transgression, to have called out this exercise in reputation laundering for exactly what it was. And I do not think this is going to be an isolated case in the combat sports field when it comes to people that want to take this critical view. And this was... Now, there has been pushback to this and, you know, support for Oliver Brown, but not everyone is necessarily going to have the backing of a major paper like The Telegraph. And there is the implied message, if you are a journalist, of this is what you're facing if you want to be critical. And there's going to be many people who are going to avoid this elephant in the room, knowing that a credential might be at stake.
Yeah, well, that's what just happened there. This is, again, Saudi is now showing that it can control the global narratives and even control narratives about the events it's hosting by simply just barring journalists from participating. And that sends the message that, you know, you don't toe the line, you're not going to be welcome here. And unfortunately, speaking for the industry as I've known it over the past 10 years and the people I've been around, that's pretty much enough to scare off most of the journalists in the space. in all honesty, there aren't that many people who come into this space hoping to be major investigative reporters or really want to approach it from that kind of combative angle. So it's difficult to look at this and not think that Saudi's just found another way to impose itself and to impose its narrative perception on different audiences around the world. And to think that the United Kingdom has reached this point where it can be controlled from a distance by Saudi Arabia speaks volumes. But this is not something limited to sports, especially in the UK. We're seeing Saudi actually and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain actually buy up plenty of the United Kingdom. It's happening in the US too. But since we're talking about the UK there are, you know, newspapers being bought up. Selfridges was just, you know, partially bought by the major department store was just bought by Saudi Arabia. They have a share in Heathrow Airport. Like, slowly they're buying up the whole country. And the UK is more than happy to place itself in this situation. Well, let's say not more than happy. They're accepting of the situation. But this is what happens when economies collapse. And the US and the UK is in a situation where it needs help from these countries that have major resources. So even in the position of global leverage, Saudi Arabia has plenty of leverage over these other countries right now. So any of these incidents that happen in sports is not going to be enough to stop UK politicians or to make UK politicians stop this at all. As a matter of fact, think back to when Boris Johnson was prime minister. You know, The Athletic published this piece with leaked emails and stuff showing that Boris Johnson was actually leaning on the Premier League and Newcastle to complete its deal, this Newcastle United English football team, to complete its deal with Saudi Arabia. They actually wanted the Saudi government to take over this football club because they thought it would help with diplomacy at the time. And the UK really needed Saudi Arabia's money. So this is the situation we're in right now. Saudi Arabia is playing its cards according to what it sees the world is right now. And they're winning.
Kareem, it's always fascinating to chat with you. We could talk about this for many hours. I do encourage everyone to go check out your new series. Episode one is out now. And can you give us a tease of what's to come? It's going to be a 3-part series. What is coming forward and where can people go listen?
So episode two is actually coming out on Thursday. So you'll find it. You'll have it Thursday morning on your favorite podcast app. So it's everywhere. It's on Apple, Spotify, etc. If you want to listen to it on the embed on sportspolitica.news, you can go there. And if you enjoy the work, by all means, join and become a subscriber. We'd love to have you. We're building the community right now. To give you a little teaser, episode two is going to focus on the time between 2016 and 2021, sort of the Trump first campaign, his presidency, and the fallout to that presidency. Everything the UFC did to be involved in that, the rise of personalities such as Colby Covington, everything leading up to about the time of the January 6th insurrection. So it's an interesting, very heavily and filled episode. It's about twice as long as the first episode, too. So there's a lot of content there, and I hope you all enjoy it.
All right. Well, I certainly recommend all of Kareem's great work. You can follow him at Zidane Sports and do support him at Sports Politica, doing a lot of great journalism out there that is very necessary, especially in this current climate and culture. And it's always great to catch up with you, Kareem. All the best.
Oh, it's always great to be back on the show. As there's so few of us, you know, sort of like-minded people, that I'm always, always delighted to be back talking to both of you.
Thanks so much. Thanks a lot, Kareem.
Take care.
Coming up this month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are bringing you 3 editions of Rewind Away, beginning with New Japan's Sakura Genesis from April of 2017 and the highly controversial match between Kazuchika Okada and Katsuyori Shibata. Later this month, we'll go back to October of 1987 with WWF's Saturday Night's main event on NBC, including title matches between Hulk Hogan and Sika, Honky Tonk Man against Randy Savage, and the Hart Foundation facing the Young Stallions. The month rounds out with WWE's Money in the Bank 2011. With CM Punk challenging John Cena for the WWE Championship in Chicago after the pipe bomb promo. Plus, Karen Peterson presents a special show focusing on the Queen of Villains on Netflix, weekly editions of Rewind to SmackDown and Collision Course, ad-free shows, news and audio updates sent directly to your email, and so much more beginning at $6 per month, which provides instant 30-day access and extensive archives going back to 2017. PostWrestlingCafe.com. All right, that was Kareem Zidane joining us. So do go check out his work in the Red Corner, covering Donald Trump and the UFC. Well, we are almost out of time here, and we are quickly going to tackle a few other topics. ratings notes from the last couple of nights. We had SmackDown on Friday night airing against the ALCS and coming shortly after the NLCS game, doing 1,378,000 viewers and a 0.42 in the demo. The ALCS game, over 5 million viewers. They were also up against the WNBA Finals, the Big Ten college football game that I was glued to between Oregon and Purdue. But there was SmackDown. Their lowest since moving to the USA Network. It was a very competitive night.
Yes, it was.
And then, and AEW Rampage, not a whole lot that can be said beyond the floor seems to have a new low every single week for Rampage in the demo. This their lowest ever at a 0.06 and 234,000 viewers.
It's almost like Rampage is going away soon.
It could be. And then we shift focus to AEW on Saturday night. They had a 3-hour block with Collision, followed by the 12th installment of Battle of the Belts. What a run it has been for Battle of the Belts. Episode number 12 falling to its lowest viewership figures to date. And this followed after Collision was preempted for 1 week due to the WrestleDream pay-per-view. And the prior episode from 2 weeks ago was against the Bad Blood show. So if you're comparing it to that October 5 show, dramatic increases. But this was down from kind of normal levels for Collision.
Yeah. This was the least watched Battle of the Belts yet by a slim margin. As I don't think Battle of the Belts is going to be sticking around for the next round of AEW rights. But yeah, this was an okay rating for Collision. They retained most of the audience for Battle of the Belts.
And then the last number was Raw on Monday night, going against two NFL games. There was one streaming exclusively on ESPN Plus, and then ABC, ESPN, and the Manning Cast all were simulcasting the other game, and Raw was at 1,578,000 viewers and a 0.51 in the demo. Their best number so far during the current NFL season. Highest viewership since September 2nd and highest 18 to 49 audience since August the 26th. So, and this was back to being a live episode after last week's taped edition.
Yeah. Did you see the clip from the Manning Cast of Ed Reed talking to Peyton Manning and Eli Manning about the Guardian caps?
No, I didn't.
I don't know if I can do it justice, but he was basically saying, so Ed Reed is a retired Raven safety, and he was talking about the Guardian caps in a very free flowing way and suggesting that, does that really protect them though? Because you get, when you get knocked out, you get hit in the chin, not the front of the head. And Peyton Manning seemed quite uncomfortable, and Eli Manning was silent.
One more, if we're talking about cherry picking certain exchanges from prominent discussions over the last week, I did want to get Brandon's reaction to our newest, educated guests. You know, sometimes you look at a crowd and it's hard to decipher, like, how many people are actually in a chosen venue. That's why we have sources such as Brandon Thurston and WrestleTix. But it looks like we have another expert out there. In conversation with the Undertaker.
You know what you've done? You've made politics fun again.
Yeah.
And I just think some people get caught up in the fact that I think they look at politics now kind of like a wrestling story, and they can't separate reality.
Well, it's so interesting because and I can't explain exactly why, but so we'll go to places and have 100,000 people show up. If Ronald Reagan came back and he went to, you know, some of the places that I go to, he'd have 250 people or 304. And that's very, very good. You know, and they do it in a ballroom someplace. And I'm getting like 50, 60, 100,000 people. It's.
Yes. Bringing the fun back into politics, which this followed a discussion about Trump being shot at. I don't even know if Donald Trump would agree that this is necessarily fun. But how about that? Yeah. 100,000 people showing up at these could outdraw Ronald Reagan in his prime.
Yes, and I'm you know, it's a shame that politics has not been fun in a while. It's fun now. I'm not sure if that's everybody's point of view, but at least that's the Undertaker's point of view.
Yeah, that's we got quite the endorsement from one Mark Calloway on this particular week's podcast. But there you go, everyone. I think we've covered everything on your checklist. We talked about what a toxic workplace culture, Saudi Arabia, MBS, Donald Trump, the upcoming election, all the topics. That,
is there any other news to discuss at this point?
There might be at a future time, but as of right now, I think we are all up to date on all the latest news. But that is it for us this week. We will be back next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time, as we will be discussing all the latest and greatest. And you can catch Rewind to Dynamite tonight right after AEW at 10:05 p.m. Eastern time here on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. Brandon is back this coming Sunday with WrestleNomics Radio at 11 a.m. Eastern time. And as always, the mailbag is open to send your questions to Brandon.
Yes. And you got to do your research, though, because if you don't do your research,
you will get fact checked.
I will do your research for you.
Yes.
And you might not want that.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me WBD is not disclosing rights fees for other sports and are hiding the AEW value? Is that what you're trying to suggest?
You can listen to this past Sunday's episode and learn all about it in immense detail.
Yeah, you better bring your A game to the mailbag, okay? So mailbag at WrestleNomics.com. Send in your questions to Brandon, and he will answer them each and every Sunday.
And there's quarter hours right now on Patreon.com/WrestleNomics for Rampage, SmackDown, Collision, Battle of the Belts, and Raw. Those are all just went up today.
Do you have any grand observations of 3 weeks of two-hour Raws? Has any patterns that have emerged, anything surprising, or is this sort of kind of at a regular level? Because I can't say there's been any gigantic shift up or down.
No, let's take a look at one of the shadow charts here. This is, I mean, it has been, let me look at these last 4 weeks are, that's a positive slope. Mathematically speaking, it is. It's doing okay. It's a little, it's on par or a little bit over where it was in the same weeks of the prior year, which is kind of what you could say about the trailing weeks, though, when it was still 3 hours. This has not changed dramatically, I would say. We'll see if SmackDown becomes 3 hours. You know, they're in this 3 month interregnum here. But I think it's going fine. Probably just an experiment, maybe to see what Netflix wants to do with it would be my conjecture.
Okay. So that's the title of the next press release. It's going fine.
Yeah. I think it's going fine. Yeah.
All right. On that note, we will bid everyone a farewell. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you again to Kareem Zidane for stopping by. Follow all of his work at Sports Politica and check out In the Red Corner, the history of the UFC and presidential candidate Donald Trump. And that is all for Pollock and Thurston.